Today's episode is brought to you by Science Socks. Whether you're into Mars rovers, the James Webb Space Telescope, or just showing off your love for all things nerdy, Science Socks has the right stuff to add that dash of galactic flair to your life. Go to sciencesocks.com/nerd, that's sciencesocks.com/nerd, to find the perfect wearables for scientists, engineers, nerds, and geeks. Science Socks, the only place in the galaxy for geeky socks and astronomical jewelry.
You are listening to a Science Actually production.
Fizzle? No, I don't. The ball doesn't have any energy. It has zero energy. All balls are made up of?
Atoms.
Can you show me neutrons? Can you show me purple neutrons? Yes.
This is a neutron.
Yes, this is a neutron.
Neutrons.
Can you take some energy? Can you take some energy? To jump up. It takes energy to jump from here to here.
And move on.
We are professionals here, and we do professional podcast recording business. And that is right. Why... two out of the three people on this episode have video.
Which doesn't matter, because Primarily this is an audio experience, so...
This is true.
You sound great.
Sound great. You sound great.
Very smooth voice. I'm gonna start this episode with two quotes, and then introduce the wonderful guest who we have with us today. So the first quote is, if you think you understand quantum mechanics, you don't understand quantum mechanics. That's a quote from Richard Feynman, the late physicist who was famous for many things, not all of them good, but he had some great takes on quantum mechanics and saying how unexplainable it really was. The other quote, which I found to be similar, was, and I'll let you guys guess where it came from. The book didn't meet my expectations. I was looking to gain a basic understanding of quantum physics in a simple and digestible manner. Unfortunately, the excessive profanity and sarcasm made it challenging for me to comprehend and follow along. Each chapter left me confused, and the main concepts were not clearly conveyed by the end. One star.
Okay.
Do we want to have a guess where that came from?
Was that me?
This was an unfavorable review left on our guest's wonderful book, Quantum Bullshit: How to Ruin Your Life with Advice from Quantum Physics. And if that doesn't give it away, guys, gals, and non-binary pals, our guest for this week is Associate Professor Chris Ferry, quantum physicist, joining us. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me.
Welcome. This is exciting.
To be honest, I don't actually read reviews, so that's new to me.
Oh, that's great.
I think that's a spectacular review, because they're basically just confirming what Richard Feynman said. Like, you have succeeded in proving his point that quantum mechanics is confusing.
Yeah. That'd be interesting.
That at least was my takeaway. But for folks who are not familiar with your work, besides doing bleeding edge research on quantum computing, Chris also has written over 50 books, I want to say, something like that, ballpark, from Quantum Bullshit, which I was just mentioning, to General Relativity for Babies and the whole For Babies series. And it's just, honestly, it's like, it's super impressive that you managed to do both of these things of like writing science communication, all of this public facing stuff, in addition to your research work. So how do you find the time? What motivated you to do this? I mean, yeah, tell us tell us about your journey. I got
that. Yeah, specifically, what was the first step that made you go to, I'm going to write a baby book about some of the hardest concepts there are?
Yeah, well,
so let's go full tilt. Quantum physics.
Like most things, I think it happened by accident. You know, so I've tried a lot of things, you know, a lot of sort of intellectual hobbies and, you know, side hustles, as they say nowadays. And this is the one that stuck. So there's like kind of two questions there. One is like, how did you get started? And then the other is, okay, well, how do you maintain it? Getting started wasn't difficult. It was just, you know, like a weekend hobby that I poked around at. So, you know, that was one book, right? And now there's 50. I wrote the first book because I have kids and I wanted to read about science for them. And there's not a lot of science books for very young ages. There's nonfiction, but that's limited to like, here's some shapes and here's some colors. And right. That what you might call, like what you might have found in science would be like animals, you know, usually farm animals, on a picture of a farm that hasn't existed for 70 years. I don't think you want to show a kid's real farm now. but there was no like real science, like modern science. So I thought, okay, well, I'll just write one for my own kids. I sent it to their classrooms. The teachers really liked it. To get it to look like a real book, I went through a self-publishing platform so I could get a printed book. And it was just one more click to make it go live on Amazon. And it was the print on demand. So you didn't have to, you know, get it printed yourself and hold stock. It costs you no money. So yeah. I thought, okay, why not? I'll just put it out there. If anyone wants to buy it, they can, you know, have a copy. And it did quite well as a self-published book. And a publisher eventually contacted me a couple of years later and said, well, you know, we'll publish them all, which is pretty uncommon for self-published books. So yeah, there's a lot of luck involved in there. And I mean, by necessity for me, because I wouldn't, you know, as you say, I don't have time to be an author and an academic, because being an author is a full-time job. Right. So it's kind of funny. I often, when people say you're an author, I'm like, I don't really do all the things that authors do, right? Authors need to make money, and the vast majority of money they make isn't from books, right? It's doing events and workshops and, you know, speaking engagements, these sorts of things, which they do day in and day out. You know, promoting their book, selling their book by hand, which, you know, I wouldn't have time to do as an academic. So it, for me, I got lucky in that I made it because I enjoyed it, had a lot of fun doing that. And then it took on a life of its own.
Cool. Yeah, it's very impressive. And I guess also, like, as you said, it's nice to have kind of been able to release it out into the world and for it to continue succeeding, because clearly the people want it.
I never anticipated. I mean, when the title Quantum Physics for Babies, which was the first book, when that popped into my head, I was like, oh, that's a winner, right? Because, you know, it's the juxtaposition of two of the most disparate things. And I never anticipated the variety of use cases for the book. Like, someone just posted something the other day saying they used it in a job interview. So it's like, you know, and then Quantum Bullshit was I wrote it for the one audience that Quantum Physics for Babies didn't work for, which was like undergraduate physicists who read Quantum Physics for Babies and say, oh no, technically that's not correct, because I just, you know, I just wrote an assignment and discovered some obscure fact. Electrons can be found in the nucleus. Okay. So you're wrong. I wrote a kind of a book for that, you know, know-it-all audience with the, you know, a bit of sarcastic humor, which I knew wouldn't be for everyone. I knew at the outset, like, there's zero chance that this book is going to get anything higher than like 3.5-star average, because a lot of people aren't going to like it. But that's you know, that's humor, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think it's got a 4 out of 5. So,
oh, well, there you go. speaking of reviews, when I first put the books online, like self-published them, mm-hmm. I did look at some of the reviews, and then I got a bad review, and I read this review, and it was like, God, this person doesn't really, it was like, it seemed like an older person without kids, and why would they buy this book? And I clicked on their name, and the previous book they reviewed was Mein Kampf. and my only solace was I got one more star than Hitler.
Oh, God.
And that's when I learned to not read reviews.
Don't read the reviews.
This is a fair point. Yeah, it's a low bar, but yeah, I'm glad that you
yeah.
It's like on Yelp. If you get a bad review on Yelp before you, you know, jump off a cliff, read the other reviews, and you're going to see like 9 times out of 10, the person leaving the bad reviews, that's what they do all day. They just leave bad reviews for everything, everywhere.
Yeah.
So absolutely. Yeah. Don't.
I see some people send me, occasionally they'll send me bad, like ones that are funny, and there's like at least five reviews on these board books that are one star because they claim the books are sharp, like they're being cut by the books. And I think I half joked, like, you know, that was by, I sharpened them myself by hand. Like, that's by
intention. Yeah, they have rounded corners. You can only help the people so much.
Yeah. So that's there's nothing you could do about it. You're like, you just can't please everyone. It's like, you know, I can make them, you know, soften them up, and then someone would say, well, they're too soft.
You have 4 kids. How do they like your books? How old are they, and what are they?
Well, doing? Yeah. So that the youngest is 8 and a half. So they don't really read the four babies books. Occasionally, we'll pick them out but we don't read them like cover to cover. We pick them up, and then it's more of a discussion, and use the images as a to frame the discussion. But they enjoyed them. I didn't like push them on them, right? They got to pick out what book they read that evening when they were younger, and yeah, they occasionally would pick my books, and I just treated it as like another book. There was a couple instances where one of them or more of them was with me when I was being interviewed, and then the interviewer asked one of the kids, like, oh, isn't it so cool that your dad is an author? And they're just like, no, like, they just assume like that's normal, right? Aren't all parents authors? Like, they have all these other books. Those are just other parents, right?
Right. There you go.
I thought you were going to say that your kid was like, wait, he didn't write this.
Yeah.
I try to talk to my own kids about the things that interest me, which is a lot of science and everything. But my kids are quite athletic, which I never was at all. And so I try to find this common ground between them, and I talk about, like, you know, the data, the statistics of different sports that they like, and I try to find patterns for them, and I'm like, isn't that cool that when they change the facade at whatever stadium, all of a sudden there's more home runs because the airflow from the outside has been blocked, and they look at me like, what are you, nuts? Leave me alone. How do you engage kids in a way that makes them think, Dad's talking about science again, but it's kind of cool, as opposed to me, which is like, they just wait for me to stop.
Well, there's a little bit of that. I think when I go out and I talk to groups of kids, it's easy because there's always one or two that are just so into it, right? But the vast majority of kids, just they kind of turn off. And that's, I think, always been true, but I feel like it's becoming more difficult, and I'm cautious of, like, you know, being the old man shaking my fist saying kids these days, but it's not just kids. So, you know, it's also adults, right? With the amount of digital distractions, it's hard to even engage adults in things that require deep and longer than 15 seconds of thought. My kids are older. The teenagers are, they're all kind of into drawing, which is, I think, is a good way to spend your time. Into drawing and art, sports is another great way to spend your time. So long as it's not just sitting there, just consuming, you know, TikTok or in YouTube or whatever it may be, just, you know, flicking through these short videos. I think that's not so bad if it can be managed, because it's good for them to learn how bad it is. So it's easier for adults, right? That you hear this all the time. So people sit there, they're flicking through Instagram or whatever it may be. An hour goes by, and you know, they come away. They're like, shit, like that was awful. I just wasted an hour of my time. And
oh yeah.
So that some people do come around, and it's sort of like, you know, it's somewhat necessary. You know, otherwise, you have this FOMO, right? This fear of missing out. Everyone else is on this platform. They're all talking about the latest trend, and I'm not on it. I'm missing out. So, but once you go on it and you realize just how vapid it is, then you can go away and do, you know, more mindful things without that fear of missing out. So it's a balance, I think. I don't push science and math onto my kids. I let them just explore and, you know, figure out what they like and what they want to do, and get, you know, what I want is them to just be immersed, get immersed in something, find something that you just, you know, get obsessed about that requires deep thought, deep work, and just do it. I don't care if it's science or math.
It's a really cool way of looking at it, because ultimately the skills, right? Like, we're no longer in the, I can't remember what the old education system used to be called. But it was basically the idea that, like, you're lacking certain knowledge, and the goal of an education is to fill you with that knowledge, right?
Right.
And with the growth of knowledge and with the ease of access to knowledge, that I think it's called the deficiency model, or it's deficit model, maybe. Like, you're in a deficit of knowledge, or whatever it's called. That's not the way that our world is. And the modern world requires, as you said, like, being able to think deeply about things and being able to work hard and deeply on things, and to think critically about whatever the topic is that you're presented with. So as long as you're working on the critical skills, the topic itself doesn't matter, I guess.
I think find something that's fulfilling. I think I don't know if it was true, but it's certainly what was ingrained in me when I was, like, in high school, leaving high school in a small town in Canada. Was the idea was you look around the town and you pick the company you want to work for, and that's, you know, you'll work there for the rest of your life and get a retirement package, and, you know, that was life, right? You know, that was what all the parents around you did, and right?
Yeah. It's grim.
You get the job and you get, you know, you work there, you're loyal, you get the benefits, and you retire with your white picket fence. And that's, you know, that's when I left school, that's, you know, what I believed in. You know, you went to university as a prerequisite for if you wanted to choose some jobs, but that doesn't exist anymore, right? I mean, the whole of the economy is a gig economy now. So how do you, it's difficult. It's hard. I try not to think about it too much, you know, for my kids, because you can fall into cynicism pretty quickly about the whole thing. But, you know, maybe it's better, you know, who knows, right? Like, that, perhaps that traditional model wasn't so good.
Well, maybe a related tangent to get us off the grim topic of the downfall of civilization. So we normally do a little ad break in our show, we've had a wonderful sponsor this year that there should have been a pre-recorded ad that you heard at the start of this episode, for Science Socks. But instead of adding another ad now from us, I thought it would be interesting for you, Chris, to pitch us this fascinating product that you have recently launched called Quokka.
Right.
I barely understand. I think that Benjamin is probably in a similar boat. So what is the Quokka What does it do? Cute. Why should people buy it?
It is tiny. It is clean. It lights up beautifully.
Yeah.
Beyond that, I assume there's way, way.
Yeah. So the Quokka is, it's a product that we initially started developing at the University of Technology Sydney, UTS, in the context of teaching quantum computing. And then we kind of spun that company out of UTS, and now we sell these devices on the website, quokkacomputing.com. And what they are quantum computing emulators. So it fits in the palm of your hand, and it accepts quantum programs, executes the programs, and returns the results. So it works in the same way as a quantum computer, but on a small scale. So it's an educational toy, you might say, in the same way, say, that, you know, the commercial 3D printer emulates, in the context of teaching, commercial scale technology. So you can buy or industrial scale technology, I should say. So you buy a cheap 3D printer, you show it to students, and have them build little trinkets, and then tell them, and now imagine this on a bigger scale, and maybe in the future we might be building houses with 3D printing technology. So that's kind of where we're aiming at for quantum computing. I mean, we can't afford to put a quote-unquote real quantum computer into a classroom, if such a thing even existed. But we can emulate it on a smaller scale. And so that's what Quokka does, right? It emulates how we envision industrial-scale quantum computing on a small scale. So and the reason for doing it is, well, it for all intents and purposes, in the context of quantum computing, like computer science, coding, programming, it is a quantum computer. You send it programs, it executes the program and returns the result. And the physical form factor is just engaging. So you, instead of the traditional route to, say, teaching quantum computing or quantum physics, where you, say, go into a high school classroom as a university lecturer or scientist, and you have a PowerPoint presentation, and predictably you just are looking at a room full of teenagers with their heads in their laps. Yep. But if you bring in a device and you drop it on the table and say, that's a quantum computer and today we're going to program it, it changes the level of engagement with the student. So that's the main and a primary use case for the device. Is an engagement tool.
Do a quantum program with the Quokka, is that something you speak to it, or you plug it into something and you enter a piece of information through your computer?
It works kind of like a Chromecast. So you have, there's an app, you onboard it onto your Wi-Fi network, and then an API is just sitting on the device waiting for quantum programs to be sent through the Wi-Fi. You can choose to give it a public address as well, so that anyone can use it. And so there are many, a quantum program is just a text file. So there are many ways to do it. Like, you can do it from the command line if you want. You can do it through our website. But the quantum program itself is very rudimentary. Like, we're talking about assembly code. So where quantum computing is today is like where digital computing was in the 1950s and 60s, right? So you write a text file, send it to the device, and the device returns the result to where it came from. So if you're doing it just by hand, like firing up the command line, you need to know a little bit of like some networking commands, like how to send a URL request. But we're creating different forms of software to interface with it, so that it's just push button.
So the text file is kind of like a modern day punch card.
Yeah, that's right. Awesome. Yeah,
that's awesome.
it's really cool, and it sounds definitely more engaging than the way that I learned quantum mechanics in my undergrad degree. Maybe just for folks who aren't familiar with like the concept of quantum computing or a qubit, can you give like a two sentence explanation of like, what is this? Why is it different? Why do we care?
Yeah, it's a different way to encode information. So digital computers encode information in bits, ones and zeros. Quantum computers encode information in qubits, and it's more than ones and zeros. Like, it's, you know, imagine all the numbers. If you want to visualize it, instead of just say two values on a plane, it's the whole circle. So it's just, it's a richer set of information, and that allows you to have more instructions you can send to it. And the reason that we want the reason why that's interesting or useful, you might say, is it allows you to solve certain problems with fewer steps. So if you constrain yourself to just zeros and ones and only ever instructions that flip zeros and ones, you require more steps to get there. But if you give yourself more freedom, then you can do it in fewer steps.
Okay.
Cool. Benjamin, how are you feeling about this?
So I think you probably have like read about it or heard about it or seen a YouTube video about quantum computing, and it'll start with qubits can be zero and one at the same time, and computations happen in parallel universes. And
that I've seen 100 times, and I've understood completely never.
Yeah, because it's not true. I mean, it's good that you didn't understand it, because that would, you know, using that as an axiom, you will deduce nothing because it's just not true and not useful. So what I described to you, I didn't mention anything in physics at all. And I think that's a better way to approach quantum computing, is to start with just the mechanics of it. It's about information processing. It's no different than digital information processing in that regard. It's just a different way to represent information. And, well, lucky enough, we have a physical world that would allow us to build machines to carry out those computations for us. I mean, you could do it by hand. Like, you can do these calculations by hand. You just wouldn't want to, right? It's just like, you know, we could, what we're doing right now, the video conferencing, is just flipping ones and zeros, right? Basically just adding bits together. You know, we could carry out that encoding and decoding by hand on pen and paper. It just would take a long time, and we would probably not be very good at it. We'd make lots of errors. So you outsource it to the device because it's blindingly fast and almost error-free. And so that's the kind of the same idea, I think, what the way to think about quantum computers is. You can do these things by hand. We know exactly the algorithm. It's just, it would take an enormous amount of time, and we would make mistakes. So why not build the device to do it for us?
Nice.
Yeah, I feel like, I mean, Benjamin, I know that you had a bunch of questions about like I don't know what like the polite way to say this, but I guess quantum quackery, like stuff like that, that people are always totally misinterpreting what a quantum computer or what quantum mechanics even is.
I think they wrap it up pretty well in the Marvel movies when they simply said, hey, have you gone quantum? I think that just wrapped it up really, I mean, done. That sums it up, right? That was accurate?
Yeah, I think there's a spectrum, right? There's sort of like in Marvel movies, they just throw the word in front of things to make it sound like you know, it's high technology that allows them to do these miraculous things. If it wasn't quantum, it'd be something else. I don't think people walk away from Marvel movies with any misconceptions about quantum physics, except maybe the last one, which was like, you know, it was somehow, you know, to travel in time, you had to visit the quantum realm, you'd go through the quantum realm in some sense. So people do, I think, come away from that thinking that time travel will be mediated by quantum mechanics or enabled by, you know, quantum technology, which, you know, is definitely not true. But for the most part, I think, you know, quantum in pop culture is fine. I mean, you're going to suspend disbelief already, right? I mean, there's people flying and shooting lasers out of their eyes. So you know, you don't walk away thinking that's real. True. But then there's like more, yeah, there's the opposite end of the spectrum is like quantum healing and alternative medicine that is using quantum, or like, I wouldn't say using quantum physics, maybe, but oftentimes, again, it's just a word that's slapped on to make it sound credible.
Like you mentioned, the quantum bullshit. There's just the hucksters out there. Just trying to sell the next snake oil, but they have the word quantum on it instead.
Yeah, so there's different. Yeah, there's different layers to it. There's different levels of sophistication. So, a great sort of innocuous example is this book called Quantum Love. It's written by like a celebrity psychologist or doctor, and the first few chapters are actually pretty reasonable, like summary. They actually went and read about it, tried to understand it. It's like Wikipedia level explanation of quantum physics, but then it just goes off the rails, right? So because then they use that sort of pop summary and metaphors and analogies, and then try to connect it to relationship advice. So it's like, I read, you know, in a perfectly legitimate venue like nature, that entanglement means like particles can communicate instantaneously or affect each other across large distances. And then you say, well, you know, the feeling of love kind of feels like that. So maybe, you know, love is mediated by entanglement, right? So there's that level of, I think, it's nonsense, but it's at least a level deeper than just stick the word quantum on something without any attempt at understanding what that might mean.
If you're
paying money for these things, then you're being scammed. And if you're using alternative medicine in place of conventional medicine, then you're potentially being harmed.
Yeah, that's kind of exactly what I was thinking, because you have you know, certain people who are trying to sell you something, and they're using it as a form of, you know, bolstering their credibility. They'll have, you know, a PhD from some online university that doesn't actually exist, and so they'll call themselves Dr. something or other, and they'll talk to you about, you know, quantum coffee enemas or something like that. And then these people are not actually like getting actual medical advice or medical treatment.
Yeah, there's a lot of it out there. And like I said, and probably you've experienced as well, there's different levels of sophistication. It's hard to think about what the average person can and should do from a scientific perspective, because, you know, it's easy for you and I to recognize like immediately when something's bullshit, right? Like,
right.
And it's hard to convey how you know that, because in a sense, it's just experience. It's just a buildup of, I do this for 8 to 12 hours a day for 10 years, right? And, you know, it's like a mechanic looking at a car and knowing right away, oh, you know, it's, you're clearly, you know, it's your carburetors messed up, right? Why? How do they know that, right? They didn't like diagnose it and run it through an algorithm. They just know it from experience. I think that's, in terms of recognizing nonsense, scams, it's not, I'm even hesitant to say like, oh, we employ critical thinking. It is just experience and, you know, seeing what legitimate science looks like versus what pseudoscience looks like. You know, there is a sense in which you develop critical thinking skills through the process of your education, but I didn't. There was never a class I took that was called critical thinking. That was like, here are the steps to be a critical thinker.
Yeah, I guess that's a fair point. And I think most of like the model that you build up, I guess, because that's in like a machine learning training sort of sense, like your model of how you interpret new information is built up of you know, all the experiences that you have, and most of those experiences are not part of your kind of like rote education of like memorize this, regurgitate it on the exam, and then, you know, congratulations, you're now educated. It's the research experience. It's kind of the being getting lost in the weeds on certain mm-hmm. topics. Benjamin has just messaged me to say that he is still recovering from my comment about coffee enemas, or quantum coffee enemas. but while he gets his breath back, I actually did have a question about your education. So you mentioned that you went to university in Canada, and I was curious. I went onto the University of Waterloo's Wikipedia page, and they have a list of notable alumni and faculty. And there is Chris Hadfield, and there is
that guy's awesome.
Another, yeah, there's Chris Williams, the guy who directed Moana, but you are not there. Why have they left this glaringly obvious gap in there?
They reached their Chris limit? Is that what it is? They reached the Chris limit.
Only two Chris's allowed?
Only two Chris's. Right. All right.
It's interesting. I think I'll touch on just one point before I forget about the previous topic, which I think the most important thing that one learns through higher education is humility, right? It's not a set of skills. It's not. I think we are trained to think that there are facts. There's this tome of facts, and you know, you go to school long enough to learn all the facts, and then you're in possession of the truth. When in fact, it's the exact opposite. We essentially know nothing. And I think coming at evaluating information and the things that you see and receive from that point of view is far more powerful. And I think that's the sort of secret superpower of scientists is humility, right? They don't know. It's not like I look at a piece of information and like, there's a magical filter in my mind that is able to discern fact from fiction, right? It's you know, you start from, I don't know any of it, right? And it's you're kind of moving the credibility needle one way or the other and then setting a filter somewhere. Why am I not on the University of Waterloo? So here's another interesting tidbit. So when you go on to an academics, you know, some academics have Wikipedia pages. Often they'll paid someone to make it for them, because it, you know, academia is a social game, and a lot of people play the game very hard. And they'll list like a bunch of awards. You know, I think there's lots of Australian awards. But when you once you sort of reach sort of that mid-career level, you see how the system works, right? The system works like, even the university will say, hey, we want to nominate you for the award. Can you write the application for us, right? So almost every award is a self-nomination, right?
Yeah.
And the people that have the most are just the people that, you know,
play the game.
Spent most of their time nominating themselves for awards. So it would be very easy for me to get my name on the University of Waterloo Wikipedia page, but I have no interest. I mean, if someone, you can do it, right? Supposedly I tried to edit Wikipedia once to correct it was actually my postdoc supervisor Carlton Caves' Wikipedia page. It said he was an American astronomer, and he's not an astronomer, so I changed it to he's an American physicist, and that it got immediately reverted back, and I was like, okay, I'm not going to waste my time doing this. So I think I could, you know, and I don't know where my Wikipedia page, I think it came from the German, like when the books were translated to German, a German article popped up on Wikipedia, and it almost surely written by the German publisher, because it, my list of accolades were just a bunch of German books, and then there's a bot that translates things, right? So I think that's how my Wikipedia page originated. Was someone wrote it in German, and then a bot translated it, and then I've had a couple I've had a couple friends. If you go through the history, I've had a couple, like, you know, friends in quotes, vandalize my page. At one point, it was Chris, aka the Quantum Tickler Fairy, and that stayed there for like a week. But yeah, I don't know. You can edit it, you know, or listeners edit it.
Yeah,
famous. You might as well just go on the Canada Wikipedia page and list me there as famous Canadians as well.
If any of our listeners,
how many languages have your books been translated into? You mentioned German. I'm curious. It's got to be at least a dozen.
Yeah. So the different publishers in other countries, they'll choose different sets of books. So they're all not translated. Quantum Physics for Babies is probably the one that's translated the most. And I think it's up to 20 languages now.
Smokes.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Oftentimes, it's funny thing about publishing is like, you don't often hear about it. So the publisher, you know, you sign a deal with the publisher saying, you know, you have exclusive worldwide rights to this book. And then they just go make deals and often they don't even tell you about it. So when I find out they're translated, it's often some, you know, some social media post in a different language, and I hit translate on it to see what language it's translated from, and I say, oh, it's been translated to Turkish. That's cool.
seems kind of backwards that the author has to go on this little sleuthing mission to find out the other countries his own work is in.
Yeah, it's. I mean, the publishing itself, it's an old enterprise, right? And it's a machine. Like it's a machine that just churns, you know, churns out. It's very sort of well organized. And it's interesting. As a reader of books before I started writing books, I had a totally different perception of publishing and the publishing industry. It's like a machine. You authors get input at one end, and books get
churned out. You've got a lot of books out there, and that's a huge, you know, contributor to science literacy. But what do you think is like the next, or what is the biggest barrier to improving science literacy in like the younger audiences today? I mean, from the little kids that do the baby books to, you know, you have teenagers now. And I found that having teenagers of my own, that the interest in the science kind of starts to fade away a little bit in high school years. And so what's that big hurdle we need to overcome?
It's a good question. I think it's, you know, it's obviously contextualized by the way in which society is set up and run, right? So you can easily just blame the education system, and you'd be, you know, warranted in doing that, because kids legally have to be at school. So if they're not being exposed to science in the appropriate way at school, then that, you know, that's certainly a problem. Mm-hmm. And I think in some sense that's true, but you also can't just like put everything on, you know, educators and the school system.
Of course.
So there's, you know, there's that aspect of it, and it's incredibly hard. There's a lot of things that are wrong, and it's very difficult to imagine how you might fix them. So just like as an example, you know, I have kids in school. The school is just down the road. It's nearly impossible for me to go. I can go to the school. I mean, it's more or less public access, like in Australia. Mm-hmm. This might come as a surprise if you have American listeners, that you can just walk onto a school campus. And so I can go into my kids' classrooms, no problem, as a parent. But if I wanted to do it as an educator or as a scientist, nope, you know. Now we have to fill out forms and send forms. Like if I wanted to go talk to my kids' classrooms, the other parents in the classrooms would have to get their parents' permission to hear me talk, in case I might say something that offends or isn't aligned with the curriculum. So they need explicit permission to do that. if I want to do an experiment, then the teacher has to fill out a bunch of risk assessment forms. You know, if I want to talk about aerodynamics and we're going to build paper airplanes, someone has to write down somewhere that a kid might get a paper cut. and
those short books of yours.
And these are all things that can be done, right? But they're all like little, like it adds up and adds up, and teachers are so overwhelmed that it's just, you know, it's enough little things so that the barrier is just high enough that it just won't be done. You know, so I can't even go into my own children's classroom to talk about science because the teacher, you know, and rightfully so, doesn't have time to deal with all of the bureaucratic nonsense to get me in there in the first place.
Yeah.
Unless they're willing to skirt the rules, right? Which, you know, I'm usually fine with, but I'm not going to recommend to anyone. That's just one small microcosm of a bigger problem in giving kids authentic experiences in science. Like, what better than have a scientist come in? But, you know, we can't do that anymore because there's too much red tape and too much bureaucracy.
Yeah.
We do it at home. We do experiments, we build stuff, we make a lot of things, chemistry sets, these sorts of stuff. It all happens at home, and that's obviously not something that every parent can afford because you know materials cost money. And it's not something that I think one of the biggest challenges in terms of like parents is that they are, I guess, afraid is the right, not exactly the right word, but in some sense, yeah, it's not fear, like people's fear of spiders, but it's like a hesitancy to engage with science and mathematics and technical things that you hear it all the time. It's usually phrased as like, I hated science in school, or yeah. I was never any good at science. Yeah. And so they don't want to engage with it. And so their children lose out in that, because the parents aren't engaging in it. And it's, a hesitancy or a slight fear of these things. And that kind of goes back to this idea of they don't want to get it wrong, right? They don't want to say something wrong. They feel embarrassed if their kids ask a question and they don't know the answer, because they're meant to know the answer to every question. At least that's what they thought was the case about science, right?
But even the scientists don't know the answers to everything, or to even most things. It's just like the journey, again, that word, sorry, but like the journey of like discovery and asking questions to try to get at a better explanation.
Exactly. So when parents ask me, they say, well, what do I do if, you know, I read your book and then my child asks me a question I don't know the answer to? The absolute easiest, you can call it a hack if you want, is just to say, what do you think the answer is? Mm-hmm. And just let them try to come up with something. And it doesn't matter if it's right or wrong.
Love it. I love it.
Yeah.
Speaking of questions, we are now at the segment of our show where we have a rapid fire round of questions and quibbles. There are 11 questions. Are you ready to face the gauntlet?
A nice round prime sure. number of questions.
Yes, nice odd prime number of questions. All right, what is the weirdest thing that you believed as a kid?
The weirdest thing I believed as a kid? Well, I can certainly remember thinking Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny were real. That's weird to think of as an adult.
That's fair.
Yeah. I think as I thought, my parents were very good at getting me to believe certain things. Like, I honestly thought my teeth would fall out if I didn't brush them like three times a day. So it's like religiously. My dentist loves me, and that's because I don't remember how they did it or, you know, how it ended up. But if I forgot to brush my teeth, it was like I was afraid that something was going to happen.
Traumatized.
Well done you.
Yeah.
Next question. Which teacher had the biggest positive impact on you?
I think it would be my grade 12 physics teacher. And it was because I had an aptitude for mathematics, and I took like an accounting course, and I thought, oh, I'm pretty good at this, and there's an accounting firm in town, maybe that's something I could do. And I'm the only person in my family like that actually even finished high school, so I didn't have a concept of you can go to university and continue studying. And so it was him who said, you know, you should think about this physics, and you know, you can go to a university and continue to study it if that's what interests you. And so, yeah, he gave me lots of like additional challenges to work on, and that really, I think, changed probably the course of my career in life, because that, you know, if not for that, then I would have been an accountant and made a lot of money and, you know, not had burning questions about the universe and been happy. I'm just kidding. You would have written
accountant. Filing your taxes for babies.
Yeah. It's been all suggested.
Right, what's one scientific discovery you wish you could have witnessed in person?
Witnessed in person? That's a great question. I think a lot of scientific discoveries are less miraculous than people imagine them to be, right? So yeah, you just see data and then you have to analyze the data for months and then you go, oh yeah, okay. But I think maybe antibiotics, like if you walk back into that lab and you're like, holy, that bacteria didn't grow in that thing, I'm onto something. I think that would be cool to see, because that's like very clear, like in your face, obvious sort of thing.
If you had to pick one historical scientist to go bowling with, who would it be?
To go bowling with.
The very serious questions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very serious show.
Yeah. I guess I would say Newton, just because I feel like he'd be super confident. He'd just, you know, work out all the angles and think that he's going to knock all the pins over, and then hopefully I could beat him. He needs to be taken down a peg or two.
Yeah, all right, yeah, for sure. All right. If you were a sandwich, what kind of sandwich would you be? The questions that keep us up at night.
Well, do I pick my favorite sandwich? A peanut butter sandwich, I think. Yeah.
Solid.
You know.
What is your most controversial opinion about pizza?
Not an opinion, but if you look up the Wikipedia page of the hometown I was born in, it still doesn't have my name on it, but it will tell you that that's where Hawaiian pizza was invented. In
really?
A small town in Ontario. Tiny little town in Ontario by Greek immigrants put pineapple on pizza, called it Hawaiian pizza, and that's where it was invented.
Love it.
So it's you could maybe say that's an opinion, because it's probably, I bet you it's contested. So I'll take that as my opinion and defend my hometown. Chatham, Ontario.
Love it. The controversial origin of a controversial topic. All right. What's your favorite scientific word or phrase?
Scientific word or phrase? I know what it is. I don't know how to pronounce it. It's the technical term for the fear of large numbers, or large words, I think it is. Yeah, the fear of large words. You just Google the fear of large words, and it's like this like 30 letter long word.
That's fantastic.
That's so cruel.
What's your least favorite scientific word?
Entanglement.
Something he works on.
Yeah.
Romantic entanglement, right? Quantum yeah. love.
Yeah.
Quantum love.
Yeah.
All right. If you could, what would you say is your favorite useless science fact?
Favorite useless science fact? Maybe a statistical fact is that most people have more legs than the average person. This is interesting.
That's thing to true.
I think another one is like Pluto won't return to the place where we first found it for another 200 years or something like that.
248 years are going around. That's right. Yeah. Okay. Let's move along. If you could rename one planet in our solar system, what would you call it?
Oh, what would I call it? Oh, maybe we revert Uranus back to its original name. Which was it like George?
George. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yeah. That's my favorite thing. That's my answer.
I knew you were cool with that question.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right,
I said we call Uranus George and we call Earth Uranus.
Or we rename everybody on Earth whose name was George.
Yeah. Uranus. To Uranus.
God. All right.
I know a couple Georges question. Where that would fit.
Last question for all the marbles. If you had to sing one karaoke song to save humanity from an alien invasion, what would it be?
I feel like I should like defer that and give you a link, and then that link would obviously go to Never Gonna Give You Up.
You would record.
I had a similar question at trivia night a few weeks ago. It was like just like a kind of fun question during the break was, yeah, pick five songs to send to an alien race to represent humanity, and I just picked Rick Astley five times.
That's gold.
I love it. All right, this has been super fun. Thank you so much, Chris, for your time and patience with our silly questions.
Oh, no worries. That was lots of fun.
Thank you for joining us.
If folks want to find you online or learn more about your work or to buy a quokka, where should they look for you on the socials or websites or anything?
Yeah, I'm inconsistent on the socials, but the I'm there. My website is csferry.com, and the quokkas are available at quokkacomputing.com, which has lots of resources to learn about quantum computing.
Nice. Awesome. Benjamin, where can the good people find you?
You can find me under the name of Science Actually everywhere. Facebook's the big one, but we're on everything. Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, the Mastodon thing, Blue Sky, we're everywhere. How about you, Kavi?
You can find me at Fun Fact Science on all the good social media platforms as well as the bad ones. That line is getting increasingly blurred these days. feel free to hit us up on the socials. Let us know what you thought about the episode, guests or topics for future episodes. And we will see you next time on the next episode of Science Actually Presents The Nerd and the Scientist. beep, beep, boop. Catchy jingle. We need a catchy jingle.
Catchy jingle. This is the part where we put in the jingle. Snappy, snappy words and songs. Makes you want to buy these products. La, 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 la. I know what you're thinking, Kavi. I know what you're thinking.
What am I thinking?
I have earlobes with holes in them that I like to stuff little sparkly things into, like earrings. What you got for me now, Science Socks?
I mean, that's perfect, because Science Socks has, like, the perfect things to shove in your tiny ear holes. They have James Webb Space Telescope tiny things that you can shove in your ear holes. They have Mars Lander things that you can shove in your ear holes. They even have, get this, they what? Even have space shuttle shaped bits of meteorite that you can shove in your ear holes. Man. Tell me where else you're going to find that.
Head to toe, Science Socks has literally got you covered. It's fantastic.
It's wild. Although I wouldn't say head to toe, I would say head and toe. Nothing in between.
Well, they do have a really cool umbrella that looks like the parachute for the Perseverance of the rover, which you hold with your hand, which is middle-ish, but then it's over your head. Whatever. Go to sciencesocks.com/nerd, sciencesocks.com/nerd. And if you purchase anything from that URL, 10% of all proceeds go to STEM programs to help kids learn science.
Amazing. 10% of your purchase could be going to a STEM charity. Fantastic. I love it. Makes me happy.
All right, everyone, hope you visit that shop. Enjoy, and many cozy footwearings to you.